for us to have a conversation about something that I think is hurting the Jewish people in the world and that we can be a light to others for. So I want to raise this with you not as speaking from on high. Really, this is among you, but something that is troubling me, not about us, but about the world. And that I think we need to be thoughtful about how we help handle it. So the issue that I've been noticing, and I'm sure you have noticed this part of it too, is that we live in a time of hyper-partisanship. We live in a time of us and them. We live in a time of children of light and children of darkness. We may not always agree who's wearing which hat, but everybody is feeling persecuted. Everybody is moving to defend their own and taking the discussion as a kind of assault. I have noticed on both sides of political debate, people defending absolutely intolerable positions, which you have a sense if it were on the other side, they would have taken a completely different stand. So the move is to defend our own and to attack theirs, even for things that we wouldn't do if the positions were reversed. And frankly, the stakes have never been higher. This is a time that's desperate for clarity, for truth, for accuracy in information, for values that are greater than group loyalty, by which we are able to then assess ourselves and those with whom we differ, and are able to attempt to come up with some kind of criteria for goals for moving forward. So I want us to talk about that because I think that includes the Jewish world, where, as if our tribe isn't small enough, we break down into sub-tribes. And the sub-tribes barely speak to each other anymore. And we caricature each other instead of engaging in real conversation. And specifically, I want to speak about the way that I think Judaism has been sundered in half by well-meaning partisans on both sides. So there are Jews who believe that the essence of Judaism is social justice and prophetic ethics. And thank God for those people, because they call us to realize that what we learn in the Beit Midrash ought to change the street and ought to lift up lives. They teach us to not be complacent with the compromises that our society and our political system pushes us to make, the willful blindness by which we learn to not see the poor and the oppressed and the weak and the marginalized as we pursue our own lives as though we are in a vacuum. So there's much to celebrate in being reminded of the centrality of social justice, but there are a good many people for whom it becomes an either or, a choice of either social justice or a rich interior life. And there are a whole lot of Jews who think that the idea of a spiritual discipline separate from issues of social justice are marginal or not engaging. And then there's the other stereotype group, the group that think that what makes you Jewishly authentic is the punctiliousness by which you observe Jewish ritual, and that social justice is window dressing, or worse, assimilation. You have all seen in the Jewish Journal last year articles decrying Tikkun Olam as if the biggest threat facing Jewish authenticity was caring about the suffering out in the world and using the wrong label for it. So what do we do with these two groups, these people who, both of them, with some very good motives, look, those Jews who argue in favor of a rich interiority and a profound observance of mitzvot, they also remind us that Judaism isn't just valuable for its social utility. It's about living in the presence of the Holy One. It's about being open to something transcendent and deeper, and that we're not simply the tagline of someone's political agenda. But both of them, I think, have turned this into a loyalty test and into an exaggerated claim in which the other is somehow treated as illegitimate. So let's explore that together for a minute. There's a wonderful phrase that the Ramban either invented or gets the credit for having quoted most prominently in Parshat Kiddushin. He talks about someone being a Naval Birshut HaTorah. Naval, you may not remember offhand, so I'll remind you. Naval was a rich farmer and landowner in the neighborhood of Carmel, where David was hiding out with his rebel warriors. And he approached Naval and asked for food. It was at the time of harvest. And Naval refused to feed David's soldiers. Now, the thing about refusing to feed the soldiers is that he had every legal right to refuse to feed the soldiers. But it's a crummy thing to do. And that's, in essence, what a Naval Birshut HaTorah is. Someone who is a jerk in a way that is legal. So they can get away with it. They're not, if doing something wrong is equated with doing something illegal, they're not doing anything wrong. But there's something unworthy. There's something uncharitable. There's something broken in their response. I want to tell you my modern Naval Birshut HaTorah story. I was traveling in Israel during rabbinical school with a friend of mine, now Rabbi Daniel Orenstein. And we were on a bus riding up to Tzfat so we could worship at the graves of all the holy tzaddikim who were there. That's actually not a joke. That's what I wanted to do. And he was tolerating it. And there were some very frum guys on the bus with us. And they got into a conversation with Danny. Not with me, because I don't think I look authentic. So they weren't even talking to me, but they were talking to him. And he, being a Brooklyn Jew raised in the bosom of our people, was speaking with the same kind of mildly Yiddish lilt that they were. So the conversation went fine until they started to launch into all of their vile ethical positions on women, on gays, on liberals, on Arabs, at which point Danny was getting more and more angry, and the guy was getting more and more angry, and they were yelling at each other about what constitutes real Torah, until Danny won the conversation by, at the top of his lungs, standing up in the moving bus, shouting, "You are a Naval Birshut HaTorah." And that's all the guy said for the rest of the ride. Me, Naval Birshut HaTorah? Me, Naval Birshut HaTorah? Like, he was so offended. And you have to imagine, this is such a learned way to insult somebody. Like, you pick a 13th century commentary to really give it to him. But Naval Birshut HaTorah is concerned only about the rules and forgets what the rules are for. And Judaism dies in that environment. The motivation for why we care about those rules drops away, which is why it's so, to me, brilliant that someone like the Ramban, who is not known as the leader of the Progressive Jewish Alliance of 13th century Spain, right? He's a fairly medakte kind of guy, but he understands that if you sever morality from practice, you're left with an abomination. You're left with someone who is technically within the limits of the law, but why bother? And beyond that, that if everyone acted like Naval, then young David would not have been able to unify the kingdom. Literally, the future of the Jewish people depended on someone saying, "I'm not obligated to do this, but it's the right thing, and therefore I need to do it." So helping us move away from that is crucial. And at the same time, there are some who are tempted to say, because the moral crisis of our time is so extreme and so pressing, that we can't afford to pay attention to the rest of Judaism. So Torah learning as a value, mitzvah practice as a value, these are all seen as assertions of privilege, as somehow illegitimate, watering down our commitment to justice. And our tradition has those stories too, right? So I think of, you're not going to like this one, Shimshon, right? The guy who was so committed to the righteousness of his own understanding that he was literally willing to bring the house down, killing everyone, including himself. And he has no Talmidim, no disciples, no students, no school of Shimshon, because there was no practice to sustain it. There was no learning to remind himself of who he was called to be. There was just one dramatic, fiery act that consumed him and everyone around him. The Talmud tells the story of one of my favorite rabbis, Elisha ben Abuya, right? The great heretic of the Talmudic period, which I admire, but that's not why I'm telling the story right now. Right? So Elisha ben Abuya is someone who dabbles sufficiently in Greek philosophy that he starts asking awkward questions, and he ends up in paradise making some speculations that get him kicked out, literally kicked out. And God says in the Talmud that there's no path of tshuva open for this guy. The hero of his story is his disciple Rebbe Meir. Rebbe Meir won't give up on his teacher, and he keeps following him around the streets of Jerusalem and saying, teach me Torah, even though you're a heretic, I want to learn your Torah. And he keeps saying, come, we'll go to a Beit Midrash, you'll see the beauty of what's going on there, and that will bring you back. So finally, exhausted by his student, Elisha ben Abuya agrees to go to some of the yeshivot. And in each one of the yeshivot, the students are learning the most horrific verses in Tanakh about the brutality of the Canaanites and how they should all be wiped out, about how Jews are superior to everybody else. In place after place after place, the syllabus of the class is supremacy, superiority, marginalization. Of course, you imagine these yeshiva boys are all putting on tefillin every morning, they're all davening mincha, they're all keeping a strict kosher, nobody will eat in anybody else's house because everyone is kosher than thou. More punctilious. But what they've forgotten is the point of learning Torah. They forgot that if you're not learning Torah in such a way that it makes you more connected to other people and to our planet, better to have not learned at all. They forgot that ours is supposed to be a God of compassion and justice and a tradition of compassion and justice. And in that context, mitzvah observance is precious because it's a daily reminder several times a day. Yes, I remember who I'm supposed to be. I remember what I'm supposed to be doing in the world. I remember who I owe my ultimate allegiance to. So this is a case where the sum is more than its parts, that the half of social justice and the half of learning and observance have to be held together. They have to be fused in conversation with each other so they are one living entity, so that we reject false dichotomies that would ask us to choose between a passion for justice and a passion for holiness. They are not only not incompatible, they need each other. It turns out that when you have two opposite poles pulling apart, there's only really one way to bring them together. Rabbi Milton Steinberg wrote a brilliant essay called To Embrace with Open Arms. If you haven't read it, I highly commend it to you. And in it, he speaks about the pull in our life is between holding on and letting go. Holding on and letting go. You want to hold on to what is precious to you, but life keeps moving on. So children grow up and move away. Parents grow old and pass away. And you will, some of you, be ordained at the end of the year and then leave us. You may not be sad about that right now, but we are. We are all of us in process, all of us moving along. And life, he said, is a series of embrace and release, embrace and release. But then he says, and this is what I want to point out, he says that when you have two poles of opposite tension, pulling in opposite directions, the way you make them harmonious is by uplift in the center. Imagine a rope with two weights on the end, and you're pulling this way, and then someone goes into the middle and lifts up. And that's his metaphor for God. The one who is the source of our ritual passion, our deep practice, our best prayer moments, and the one who commands us to care for the widow and the orphan. That divine uplift allows these two poles to pull together, to be better as partners together. So what I would like to invite us all to be, in the words of the liturgy, is Ana Abda Dekud Shabrihu. I am a servant of the Holy Blessing One. And to know that in that service, there's ultimately no ritual that lacks a moral core, no moral commitment that doesn't need reminder. And to understand that it is the living network of Jewish practice, both ritual and social, that has allowed us survive across the ages and made us worthy of that survival. So as we launch this new semester, I bless all of us to be, as we understand it, warriors for justice, to not accept the bland apologies of an empty time, and to be able to insist that we can all do better and that we can help our world be better. And to understand that to replenish our own inner resilience, our own ability to have real abiding hope, to remember that tomorrow can be better than today or yesterday, requires moments of holiness in which we simply bask in the light. Ritual and justice together. We need to do that. We need to do that for ourselves and for the world. That's hopefully what we're learning at this rabbinical school and what I invite you to take with you on all of your journeys. Welcome back. Shalom.